Hello, and welcome back to BTAC, Beyond the Bulletin. I'm your host, Dr. Kristen Schneider, and I'm here today with my co-host.
Hey, I'm Pete Lapp. How are you? Kristen, we're into this together in the same room again.
I love it. It's good to be here in person with you, Pete.
It feels like it's been a while since we were in this room recording. We just got some good news.
Literally
just got some good news.
Within the last 30 seconds.
30 seconds. And no, it's not like there's more coffee coming in.
That would be good news.
That'd be really good news. The first podcast of Beyond the Bulletin has been approved.
Officially approved by the attorneys
to get
posted. So folks will be getting to hear that. Well, by the time they're hearing this one, they'll have heard that one.
We love our attorneys.
Yep.
Just for the record, we really appreciate our attorneys.
Thank you, OGC.
We thank them for expeditiously getting through the podcast and reviewing it and making sure so that we get out the door. I know it's a tough time with the government shutdown, but we appreciate their tenacity.
Indeed.
In the review.
And letting us plow forward with this, because we've got another great episode scheduled for today.
Today. And we have we have two special guests.
We do.
The first one we have to introduce. So, when we introduced James,
yes,
I described him to our audience as our boss's boss's boss.
That's right.
But today, sitting in for Brandy, who is our boss,
mm-hmm. We've got our boss's boss.
Boss's boss. Brandon Neesant is in the room with us today. And Brandon, let me tell you about Brandon real quick. So Brandon was our boss, and then he got promoted. And then he just celebrated a big milestone.
Mm.
Big milestone. Not only is this his first podcast.
That's right.
As a contestant, as a guest, as a contributor. Right?
I think so, yeah.
First one,
absolutely.
Avid listener of podcast, consumer. So we've got definitely constructive criticism that's been well appreciated, but like you're also 50 years old.
Yeah, it can be pretty daunting, can't it?
It could be. Yeah. I mean, I'm 5 years beyond that, so I've gone through that trauma of turning 50. And I said to you yesterday, it's all downhill. What did you say to me? You said, no, it's a back nine.
It's a back nine.
I like that approach.
I'm going to learn from the front nine and make those adjustments, and I will come out on top.
Good.
Yeah, well, absolutely.
We're looking forward to seeing if you can shoot under 100, to put it in a golf analogy.
That's right. Golf analogy here.
But thank you for joining us today.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
And then, Kristen, you're going to introduce our special guest.
I am indeed. Our interview guest for today is our own BTAC, Dr. Whitney Fouth, who is our employee management relations expert on BTAC, one of our two EMRs. And we are just delighted to have Whitney here today to talk with us about the topic of difficult conversations. And so we're going to get into that. But first, want to just ask Whitney to introduce herself a little bit. We know Whitney well, but tell our listeners a little bit about yourself, Whitney, maybe starting with your current role. What do
Sure.
you do for the BTAC?
So for BTAC, we take the cases that we get and we look at them through the lens of human resources and also employee relations, which is really relevant to our folks who are represented by collective bargaining agreements. That could be a little different across employees. So we are just taking what we get and trying to understand it in a way that looks at the well-being of employees mm-hmm. and how we provide information back to their leadership for keeping them whole, right? So while they're at work, is understanding what they need from the organization in terms of the risk they're presenting, and how we can really help them continue to succeed if they're able to. Sometimes they're not. Sometimes we get cases and we say probably the best solution is the termination proceeding that's already happening. And but we invest so much money. Our contract partners invest so much money in employees that we take the time to try to understand what we can do to remedy the situations whenever possible.
So you bring up a really good point, which is that we've got different types of potential individuals that are involved, right? So I think a lot of times when people think of the department, they think of our uniformed services, right? And that's part of our population that we're thinking about is our active duty, our National Guard, our reservists across all of the branches. But we're actually thinking about other people as well, right? Tell us about some of the different groups of folks that we have to think about and that we might need different types of strategies for from an employee perspective?
Yeah, I mean, it's a really interesting, I mean, it's interesting to me, it's my job, but a lot of people think that we are really focusing on the military personnel, and interestingly, that's probably the least of what we do, because the military processes are so well defined when it comes to risk management. Civilian personnel are a totally different story because they all have different leadership chains. They're working in massively different organizational cultures that are driven by civilians. The military cultures, in a lot of ways, drive themselves because they're so well established. But in civilian organizations, that is not the case. And, you know, anytime you have a leadership change in any organization, it can shift. So you just have all these pockets of civilian employees working with military, with contractor employees, and there are just different things going on in all those organizations. Mm-hmm. So you have to be mindful that there are so many differences and nuances when you're looking at any given set of employees. Then we also look to some extent at our contractor employees.
Yeah.
That is, you know, we're contractors and we have our own culture within our group, which is so you have these layers of culture. And I think that's really where we come in with EMR, is not just looking at processes, but also trying to understand what's going on in that organizational culture in a way that we can say, here's where that culture might influence the risk, because that's, you know, when we're talking about things like, I want to use toxic leadership very carefully, but people perceive that differently across different cultures. And so contractors have this really unique experience. Civilian employees have a unique experience, and our military personnel have unique experiences. So, and then you have your dual added personnel, right? So
very true.
So that's a different set of concerns that you're looking at, is how do what we're dealing with one person who is dual hatted, or, you know, they're a reservist and they're civilian employee, what does that look like for both of their organizations if they're presenting a risk?
So can we go back a second? Because, like, you know so much about the employee relations side of things, and you're an organizational psychologist.
I am.
What made you decide to want to be an organizational psychologist versus a clinical psychologist, an operational psychologist? Kristen, help me out
here.
Like,
well, and
all
the
psychologists.
Yeah. And what is the difference? For a lot of listeners.
You can't prescribe a medicine. Like, you can't
not want me to, no.
No, but to an organization. You can't, like, hey, here's a pill for you, take this. Like, what does that entail, being an organizational psychologist?
Well, I'll start. You said, you know, kind of how did I get there? And I got there through self-preservation. I started as an 18-year-old psychology major thinking I was going to change the world, and I wanted to be a child psychologist. And I'd say that God granted me the wisdom when I was like 20 years old to know that I couldn't handle that. And I started working when I was 16 years old and was really interested in why people act like, you know, idiots at work. I was always really like, what's going on with them? And so I had a business professor. I was a business minor, and he was an industrial and organizational psychologist. And that's what interested me. And I went that direction. And, you know, so really it's we talk a lot about organizational culture. We as an organization, and people can't see me, but I'm the broad we talk a lot about what culture means. But we also talk about climate, leadership styles, how they affect how people act, because one individual can behave very differently with two different leaders. And so the interesting thing about organizational, and I put air quotes around organizational, because we're talking about how people act when they're at work and what motivates them, but it's all in the guise of all these individuals and how they're playing into that environment. And so that, I mean, I'm fascinated by it. It might not be that fascinating to a lot of people, but I am fascinated by why two people will behave very differently in the same organization.
That's kind of cool. That's like really, really fascinating. I do think it's interesting that you were interested in why people act odd at work versus in real life, just walking down the street, how you were able to make that distinction between, I don't really care what you're doing on the street corner, but when you're at work, why are you acting differently? That's really fascinating to me.
The different types of factors that are involved that might be different in a work environment,
and
different push and pull.
Everybody's different. And that's what, you know, trying to manage that when you look at it from a leadership perspective and saying, what's going on with that person that might influence how they're acting today versus tomorrow. And, you know, in our world, if they're presenting a risk, what's going on with them that might be contributing to that risk? And it's really contingent on leadership to have that pulse on their employees. And so I'm also super interested in how leaders, I just love to look at how leaders interact too, because it just, man, it really affects how people show up to work and how whether they want to show up to work.
Yeah. Well, so tell us a little bit more about your path to the BTAC. And I have to admit, you and I have worked together for many years. Full disclosure, Whitney and I have been friends and known each other for a long time and worked together. So I know the answer to this, but tell our listeners a little bit more, because I think for a lot of these types of careers and positions, people don't necessarily know how you would even start to do something like this.
They don't. I am asked fairly regularly. I don't go broadcasting what I do, but...
Except for today.
And then we're going to make this public so I can do whatever I want now, right? They say, how did you get into that?
Yeah.
How did you start doing that? And I was in University of Oklahoma, grad school, Boomer Sooner. And I was given the opportunity for an internship in Monterey, California with the Defense Personnel and Security Research Center. So that was...
Wow.
In 2001, and I'm going
there's a golf course there.
Really, right. Pete really wants to play the golf course there. Yeah.
Pete's a little excited about the fact
it's
that.
It's in my budget.
we're all going to go.
It's actually coming out of the kids' inheritance, but that's another story.
They don't need to know.
No. Well, this is live, or not live, but they'll hear this.
It. We can edit this out, right?
Yeah, please.
Yeah, okay. And so, you know, I didn't really know what I was getting into. We had been doing some research studies for the CIA. Mm-hmm. And so that was really interesting. And, you know, I was a small town Oklahoma kid. I didn't have a lot of exposure to that sort of stuff. But, man, you know, that was the sexy stuff. Like, everybody wanted to work on those studies. And so that kind of led into the internship out in Monterey. And that just turned into my full-time employment. And so we're 25 years on, and I spent a lot of time doing psychological research, not like Milgram study type things for people who know what that means, but looking at how people behave in terms of their personnel security clearances. So why are people eligible or ineligible, studying the process. I feel really fortunate to have been part of the team that researched and implemented continuous evaluation.
Oh, wow.
And
that was a
10 years
win.
Worth of mm-hmm. work. And then I spent a few years in executive leadership with contractors, and then doing organizational effectiveness and leadership development for executives. And so that was really fun. It was just really interesting to help leaders lead. And so then I went back to doing research because that was really my calling. And here I am, you know, I've been with BTAC a year now, but having been doing insider threat work for, quite a while.
But we should be clear. We're not talking about executive therapy.
No.
We're talking about executive coaching.
No, listen.
Mentoring. There's some executives that need some therapy.
Pete, this is true. I had someone assigned to me as punishment once.
Oh.
I was their punishment.
You were their punishment.
Yeah. But it was a mentoring opportunity, and it helped someone learn how to talk to people. And so, you know, it's good we're having this conversation
today. I love
how
you turn a challenge into an opportunity.
Indeed.
That's just amazing.
Well, and it's part of the reason we wanted to have you come to talk with us about this topic in particular, difficult conversations. One, you know, as we were going back through the other bulletins and sort of looking at ones that we might bring back for one of these initial podcasts, difficult conversations is such a fun and potentially interesting topic from a behavioral threat assessment perspective. We have to have a lot of difficult conversations, and we have to guide people in how to have difficult conversations. But I couldn't think of anybody who's sort of more expert at having them, about crafting them, and who could really speak to why that's important to this type of work and specifically to insider threat than you could. So I'm just excited to have you here to talk with us about that today. But I'm curious, what are, generally speaking, the kind of difficult conversations that you see coming up most often in workplace environments? Are there any kind of Are there any kind of consistencies or repeated themes that you see, the types of conversations that people really struggle with?
I mean, yes. I think the answer to that is yes. You know, in the work that we are doing, we see a lot of misconduct. Mm-hmm. And so we spend a lot of time thinking about how we are advising leaders to address misconduct in a way that reduces the personal threat that people feel. You know, you want that more authoritative approach to those leadership conversations versus I have the power and you're going to do what I say. Because every case that we get that comes across our desk, our goal is to remediate the risk, not to exacerbate the risk,
yes.
Right? And so if someone's already in trouble, they've done something and there's a concern and we're trying to figure out how to approach them, the last thing we want to do is spin them up further, create new grievances, and give them additional motivations to really try to get even, right? Because every time you're dealing with somebody who's acted out at work, well, not every time, but many times, you're talking about people who feel like they've been wronged, and they're just trying to they are trying to level the playing field, right or wrong. They're trying to get their sense of justice and fairness back. And so when we look at how leaders talk to people in those environments, it's how do they speak to them in a way that doesn't further the sense of unfairness, and if at all possible, bring back a sense of justice to them.
So like Dr. Eric Shaw in his Critical Pathway would talk about the organization's role in insider threat. And he refers to the maladaptive organizational response, which, you know, my Tatum friends are like, they probably have to drink, because every time we talk about maladaptive organizations, we drink a sip of water. We talk about it a lot, but you're trying to get an organization to act adaptively, a positive way, so that we don't increase the risk by making this employee feel worse than he or she already does, or behave worse than they already do.
Exactly. And Pete, you know, you've been spearheading the conversations that we've been having about humiliation.
Yeah.
And I think we've all, at this point in our lives, have faced at least one experience of something that was humiliating, and knowing how that makes you feel, I like to think, you know, I'm looking at you guys, we're pretty well adjusted. And so we can work through that. But when you have someone who's already feeling like they're in a delicate balance, or they have external stressors that people don't even know about at work, right? And then they just have that one thing, that sense of humiliation can be that thing that just breaks them. And so, you know, if you have a set of leaders who are unaware of that, willingly or unwillingly, they can even unintentionally make the situation worse, because they're not attending to the things that might just push that person to a breaking point. And so, I mean, we don't use the word compassion a lot in what we provide back when we're working our cases, but we do talk about dignity and respect.
Well, correct me if I'm wrong, like, you know, with military folks in uniform, and I had been one in my previous life as a National Guardsman, but active duty, folks that are like in the Marines, are they identify with that uniform. They identify with the Marine Corps as an example. And if that's taken away from them involuntarily, that could be a degree of humiliation that is necessary for the greater organization. But we have to represent and recognize that there's some residual possible issues that could result about taking away their identity.
It's huge.
Yeah, it's huge. And I feel bad for those folks. But then how do we do that as from an organizational psychology perspective? How would you coach a leader to be cognizant of that identity stripping?
Or maybe the flip side, which is, how do you not do this? I mean, what are the ineffective ways that you've seen? I can
the
imagine.
Ineffective ways.
Sometimes that paints a clearer picture.
It's only an hour podcast, right?
That's true.
We got an hour here.
Give us
right?
a couple of examples.
Highlights.
I think what's really interesting in the military is that there is there's a sort of, I don't know if rigid is the right word, and Brandon will correct me, but really well-established doctrines. Each of the services have their own associated doctrines
yeah.
that guide a lot of the acceptable behavior and then their own standards of conduct. And so a lot of times when you have people who are, for whatever reason, being discharged and that sense of their identity is being threatened, it's been procedurally guided.
Mm-hmm.
And that's critically important for perceptions of fairness. So you have some individuals, and I'm not even answering your question, but you have some individuals where it's very procedural, and even though it might damage their sense of identity, they understand that what they have done is incompatible with their service. And yeah. so that's very understandable. It's where you get those more ambiguous things, the misconduct that one CO might consider misconduct, and then another might say, oh, we're just going to let it ride, or I'm just going to write this in their local folder. And those things build up. And those are a lot harder when they're dealing with identity. So, you know, seeing those leaders, I'm trying to think of a specific example of where that's been done poorly. I mean, without many details, of course, I actually saw that in a civilian organization with two former military personnel, where there was a conflict of identity.
Mm.
And one of them ended up having to leave the organization. And it was really, to me, handled poorly, in my opinion, handled poorly, because it was kind of a pointed, you don't know anything about this based on your experience in your service. So it was an actual shot to the heart of that
personal.
Person's identity. Mm-hmm. And very personal. And I think that's the worst thing you can do as a leader, is to make it personal. And in the military, it's just very, I think the military is so well structured, fortunately, in terms of misconduct. But you know, they're also, you see things sometimes, you're like, now simmer down a little bit, you know, don't target their character if you don't have to.
What about avoidance? You know, with difficult conversations, this is one of the things I think, you know, I come to the thought of difficult conversations less from an employee management, more from, you know, my background is a clinical psychologist. I have a lot of difficult conversations, and I coach a lot of people to have difficult conversations. And a lot of times people just really want to avoid them. Does that happen in workplaces?
All the time.
And what does that lead to? What are the consequences of that you
so
see?
So avoidance is extremely common, and you have it in several places, right? You can have avoidance of difficult conversations between coworkers because people don't want to rock the boat. And that's I think, less concerning depending on the environment that you're in. But avoidance from leaders is really particularly damaging, because I think avoidance of those difficult conversations is more damaging than poorly managed difficult communications. Because when it's poorly managed, at least your leadership is showing, hey, we're trying. You know, we might not be doing this right. We might get this wrong. We might have to start over. But we are trying to do something. And so when employees can see, hey, this thing has happened, especially if it's fairly public, but I see my leadership trying to do something. I don't agree with what they're doing or it's backfiring, but they're trying. Avoidance, sometimes it's unintentional. You know, like the leader might not even, I think supervisor is probably a better layer of an organization to talk about. They might not even really be in the know of some of the things that are going on, but they should be,
yeah.
right? So they should be, that's their job. But when they are intentionally avoiding it, the sense of, and we talk a lot about injustice, I mean, because that grievance development yeah. based on perceptions of unfairness, when someone's really made a mess of things at work, it's affecting their coworkers. We've all been in these situations, right? And their supervisor, their manager, or even their more senior level leadership, they just don't even address it.
Yeah.
People get mad. And I don't know anyone who can't relate to something's going on at work. I don't feel like that person is being appropriately managed, but nobody's doing anything about it. the message that it sends to the rest of the workforce is that leadership doesn't actually care enough about you to try to correct this situation. So it's really not even the effect that it has on that person that's causing the issue. I mean, there is an effect there as they're not getting the appropriate care and feeding that they need. But the effect that it has on people around them is can be really, really dramatic. That a lot of times, like in industry, what you'll see is people just leave. And I mean, that's a huge risk for an organization is if people just start bailing out, you're losing your talent, you can't achieve your mission. But avoidance to me is really one of the most dangerous things that can happen.
When I write some of my consults, one of my go-to recommendations from a management perspective is to set the rules, communicate those rules to the individual and enforce those rules. Because I think it shows and that's a threat management, part of a threat management strategy, making sure they know what the rules are and enforcing it. And it also shows the others that aren't the problem children, if we will, that there's people are watching and there's somebody in charge and they're enforcing some discipline. I think that's a very important point that you make.
And from an HR perspective, you guys will see in my consults, I very, very often, I suggest that leadership work with HR.
Yep.
Work with HR to develop a plan. And probably one of the most common things you have coming out of EMR at BTAC is set expectations. Put them in writing. Very clear expectations. Put them in writing. Make sure the individual understands them. So that's having them tell you.
Communication.
What did you hear me say? What do you hear me telling you is expected of you going forward? And then, like you said, expectation setting.
Yep.
And so part of that expectation setting is identifying consequences for failing to meet those expectations. We are bad at that. I mean,
The greater we,
not we. We are phenomenal, of course, at everything we do. I have seen that over and over, and I've been guilty of that. Managers, like mid-level managers, I know some people really aspire to that, and I have to tell you, it's a really difficult role to be in because sometimes you have 20 to 30 subordinates and you're just trying to manage the day-to-day and get your checklist done.
The mission.
And you don't take the time to sit down with people who are struggling and say and I'm not talking about performance is a different set of difficult conversations. Conduct and performance need to be treated separately, but to take the time to sit down with someone and say, I see this happening, this isn't appropriate conduct for this organization, here's what I expect from you, and taking the time to write that down and make sure they understand it, because it takes time. I mean, you're talking, even if you meet with that person for 30 minutes, you've spent, 12 to 20 hours on the front end, and we'll have another 4 to 8 hours on the back end.
Yeah.
It's a lot of time when you think about having a lot of employees, so do effectively.
And a lot of times people will avoid those conversations because they bring up really difficult emotions, right? Not just for the person who is behaving in a way that's concerning. It can be a difficult conversation for them, but especially for the person trying to initiate that conversation to get that started. Do you have any guidance on, every one of these conversations is different, but are there any kind of basic rules that we can use to get us started for those times when we are avoiding, we're procrastinating because we know this is going to be a difficult conversation?
Well, so the first one is get ahead of it. We talk a lot about documentation. And I know the years that I was set in leadership roles, documentation, when you see things happening, a lot of times they're so sub threshold stuff, you don't really think, hey, I need to write that down or I need to make a note of that. And I think that just sort of my message to managers, anybody who's in a management role, is at the point where you're like, you kind of tilt your head at someone's behavior, you probably need to make a note.
Yep.
Because if you are documenting things early, then you can enter into these difficult conversations with information. None of us like to be accused of doing something without examples of what we've done that represents misconduct. And if you have, if you're just relying on memory, well, this one time you snapped at so-and-so, and I don't really remember the context, that's not helpful. That is just not helpful for an employee. So that's the first one. I mean, I've always encouraged the managers that I've worked with is just write it down. It doesn't have to be formally filed with HR, but
document.
Get yourself prepared for the conversation.
Yeah. Document so that you can be clear and specific.
Thank you, Kristen. That is perfect. Clear and specific as you can be to help them understand this was not appropriate behavior. The other thing is use your resources around you. And that oftentimes means that you aren't perhaps the right person to address the issue. We work in our multidisciplinary team, so we see every single day how inordinately valuable it is for us to have other experts around us. But I would encourage, use HR, security. People, listen, I'm going to plug security offices because they are an incredible resource managers really need to reach out to say, can you help me understand if this is something I should be concerned about? And so really being prepared. I know the bulletin, the Difficult Conversations bulletin talked about message mapping. I'll be honest, it's not something I was ever good at, but getting prepared. And we do talk a lot when we're making recommendations about if you're planning for a meeting that's going to be difficult, be very prepared. Don't go off the cuff. Make sure that you've gone in understanding what you want to say. And especially when the content is very difficult, we deal with some really egregious things. Sensitive, triggering, and in management and leadership roles, it's contingent on that leader to understand whether something's triggering for them in a way that they can't address it fruitfully, and to draw in people that can help them. Those are sort of some big ones for me, is just being prepared and using your resources. And the other thing is plan to make it a two-way conversation. So you go a long way in this whole perceptions of fairness thing by giving people voice. So listen for their explanation of what might be going on, because there's a saying, don't believe everything you think, and we never have the whole picture. And so to get their perspective is going to give you more information and also give them a chance to feel heard. And I think we all know that sometimes all we want is to be heard. So you can defray a lot of stress and anxiety and bad behavior just by listening.
I heard recently this phrase, and it originated with Stephen Covey, seek to understand before you seek to be understood. Yes. And I was like, wow. I took a note. I wrote it down, frankly, because it's like it really makes sense. A lot of us just want to be heard.
We do.
It's okay if we're wrong or if we violated a rule, but like, hear me out. And a maladaptive supervisor may want to shut that down and say, no, you violated a rule and this is what we're going to do to address this, and not really strive to understand why did you do that?
Especially when you're dealing with a situation that's based on complaints from other people, because you get the tiniest piece of the picture, right? And so if someone in a leadership position who just reacts with that without getting additional information, you're fueling that fire.
There's always two sides to a story.
Or four, or 20.
Exactly. And there's always my version, your version, and then the truth.
The truth.
All right. Yeah, so that's a great one. Going back to first of all, let me give you promote HR. From an insider threat perspective, I think, frankly, with no disrespect to my other multidisciplinary team folks, HR is like the key player. When you think of, someone acting up in a meeting consistently, sub-threshold, HR might see that because that's interpersonal, that's in a meeting, but that's a potential risk indicator. If you have an individual who keeps acting up, who's abrasive, who's passive aggressive or even aggressive, that could be an indication that they don't respect authority, they don't respect rules, they don't respect the law. By the way, here's classified information I just provided to the media. you know, in response to that. But those little sub-threshold things that HR sees, I think, are so enlightening when we think about the whole person.
I couldn't agree more, Pete. I mean, it's understanding there's something off that could adversely affect this organization and the people in this organization. And we are so tolerant of those sub-threshold behavior.
Sub-threshold behavior, so important. It's seen. Someone sees it. Someone sees someone in their a coworker who's, you know, got their feet up on their desk, who's, you know, being disrespectful to a fellow colleague or even a boss.
Yeah.
Talking behind their back. These are all indications that that individual is on a bad pathway.
And we ignore it. There's a whole line of research that my colleagues at PERSEREC worked on about coworker and supervisor reporting, and the things that prevent people from reporting concerning behaviors. And one of the biggest ones is people just aren't sure.
Yeah.
They don't feel confident that this is really something they need to be concerned about. Oh, that person is quirky, or they're always cranky. And so we're really prone as humans to giving other people more benefit of the doubt than sometimes we should. And that's hard. That's a hard one. I'm not going to tell anybody exactly how to handle that. But I will say, the more you have a leader or someone in HR who knows their people, they're going to understand an individual's baseline to understand whether that's really anomalous behavior. But one thing about that, you know, like the disruptive, disrespectful, those people that are just kind of stoking the fire all the time.
Yeah.
It's a great opportunity for their leaders to step in and say, I see you.
Yeah.
You know, sometimes that can be the most effective thing, is that behavior is not acceptable.
Yeah.
That's a 5-minute conversation. Hey, I see this. It's not good for our environment. Because what happens is we just let it go on. And then people feel more emboldened to sort of escalate their behavior. And then it becomes actual problem.
But addressing it requires us to be willing to have that potentially really difficult conversation. If that person is being disagreeable and difficult already, you can kind of anticipate sometimes that conversation about that behavior is potentially going to be challenging. And I think maybe that's part of the avoidance of not wanting to have to engage. And yet it's absolutely critical.
It's critical. And I think a lot of it is we don't train managers to have those conversations. We promote people, so still today, we promote people out of technical competence. And we don't sit back and take the time to even give them the basic rudimentary understanding of people skills and how to sit down and say, I'm concerned about this behavior that I'm seeing. Because honestly, when you're in those early stages or those things, you're kind of going, I'm not sure whether how concerned I need to be about this. Those conversations aren't really that difficult, frankly. They, you know, if you're starting, when you first see behavior, it's I've seen that, and that's not really going to fly right now. Let's not do that. And a lot of people won't do it anymore because they're being, you know, it could affect their performance ratings. It could, so they say,
climate surveys,
my behavior's not appropriate.
Right.
And some people just need to be told your behavior's not appropriate. And so I'm not saying it's not a difficult conversation, because for some people it's confrontational and they're very uncomfortable. You know, I'm not uncomfortable with confrontational conversations, but,
I know,
Pete.
No, but you're right, Whitney. A lot of people, that is the difficult part to, you know,
they're afraid
to, generally speaking, I think the two buckets of questions or issues that people really struggle with are saying no or setting a boundary or asking for help. Mm-hmm. Right? And these are the types of conversations that we're talking about. So for the supervisor, the manager to say, no, you can't do that.
Right.
You can't behave that way. That's not acceptable here.
And
that is hard for people.
And, you know, the thing is this, it really goes back to how the organization is set up. Because if that code of conduct exists, if those standards have been spoken and modeled, then you have a foundation for those types of behaviors not to be accepted. So it really, you know, like I was saying with documentation, with the conversations, is starting early. This is going way, way, way earlier. And having an established sort of code or culture that says we're not going to accept that kind of behavior, so that when those types of misconduct do occur, employees can pretty much expect that they will be called on their conduct. So it's a long game. It's a really long game to get to a place where you can effectively have difficult conversations. You can't. It's really hard to just start one day and say, "We're just going to hold you accountable for this," when people have never been held accountable for it. It's very difficult.
So can we? I know you're an organizational psychologist, but I also know you're not my organizational psychologist. I've been told that I am a little difficult to manage by several previous bosses.
I don't believe it, Pete.
No, it's true. It's true.
You have been told
that. It's true. I have actually been told that. Let's role play here for a second. How would you have a difficult conversation with me? And Brandon, I saw you pull out the notebook. You're going to start taking notes here on how to have this difficult conversation. I see you.
This is a dangerous spot for me. I'm in the audience with, you know, these perspectives and these strategies. Yeah, I'm taking notes.
This is a hypothetically speaking.
We might get shut down here in a second.
How would you have a difficult conversation with a guy like Pete, one-on-one, who follows the rules most of the time, definitely follows the law all of the time, except when we refer to speeding and driving laws, but like just kind of like wants to do things in a way that may not align with, just feels like he can make that decision when he's not really empowered.
Well, we're going to assume Pete is a high performer, right?
High enough. Yeah, relatively high.
That's an important thing to consider, right? Is how, you know, how critical is this person to our operations, and what do we need to look at in terms of how they're contributing?
But then are we treating him fairly compared to a low performer? Like, because is that would a low performer see that as justice? I don't know. It brought up an interesting question to mind.
I think you I don't think it's not giving passes. This is a fact. When you have a workforce, you have some people that are more critical to the success of that mission. Okay. And if they're doing a good job, then you really want to dive down and see, what do I need to do to retain this person?
Okay.
And so for, you know, if we're having this, you and I will never be in this situation, thankfully, but Brandon is taking notes. I would start with, how are you doing? Because
you're seeking to understand.
There is a level of compassion that has to come in when you enter into any difficult conversation, because you are working with a human being. Even in some of our cases of most egregious misconduct, starting with compassion is going to be better than starting with accusation.
Yeah.
So how are you doing? I've seen this, whatever's happening. You know, you and so-and-so have kind of been in conflict lately. Tell me about that.
Yeah.
What's going on? What's your perspective there? Here are some of the complaints that we've had. That's a really important thing, to be transparent and honest. Not to say, oh, well, there have been complaints. That helps no one, to have pie in the sky, ambiguous information. You know, so you've been, you know, I don't know, fighting with so-and-so over X, Y, and Z. And tell me your perspective on that.
So clear and specific. And then seeking to gather more information.
Yeah. And the type of words you use are super, super, it seems like they're super important. How you use your words to ask that question or make that statement are super important.
And I would also, we talk EAP. I think I use EAP in my language more than I ever thought I would. Many times a day, EAP comes up. And so I am actually not a huge fan of just saying, here's the phone number for EAP. Honestly, that drives me fairly crazy, because that is not helpful for people for whom mental health care has been stigmatized, and EAP has been equated to mental health care. I'm a big fan of saying, here are some resources available to you by the organization. They might be through EAP or not, but that I think could really help either your performance or managing this stressor in this situation. If there's misconduct involved, you have to be very honest about that misconduct and say, that is unacceptable behavior in the future. Here's what we expect to see. And you can be compassionate through that entire conversation. You can approach people with respect and dignity no matter what they've done. And we see cases where we are not feeling like that is actually deserved. That's a very difficult part of our job, is seeing the cases where we think, I don't want to have to ever talk to this individual. But the fact is, somebody is going to have to talk to that individual.
Yeah.
And so whoever is it, whoever gets tagged for those conversations, the first thing is really to say, whatever they've done, they're either traumatized, because we see some bad things.
Yeah. Yep.
And you it's helpful for me if I were to have to go into a room with them to try to think, I don't understand where they've been, where they come from, what traumas they might have experienced, and what stressors they've had that have gotten them to this point. It never excuses the behavior. You do not have to excuse the behavior to recognize humanity.
Right.
And to me, that's the most important thing you can do to defray exacerbating a risk profile for someone, is just treating them like a human being.
I feel like I've been heard. I honestly feel like I've been heard. Thank you. I know we're hypothetical.
That is the idea, though. I mean, and it
goes
a long
But if
way.
Brandon calls me when he needs to have a difficult conversation you with coach. You, I don't know how this is going to go.
You coach. You're his coach. That's fine. No, I actually, the way, and your tone, I love the way you comport yourself, and I love the words you chose. They're so deliberate, intentional, and caring. Like I wish all leaders could just replay that, listen to that over and over again, write it down, how the words that you chose, because it meant to me. I'm playing this out in my mind hypothetically, but I'm like, my boss really cares about me. Let me tell you why I did what I did that was stupid. And I know, and I'm sorry. I get it. That was really, really helpful to me. Thank you. Yeah.
People get less dug in when they have a chance to vocalize what's going on with them and to explain. And it does help us to gather more information.
And Kristen knows better than you guys, but I've had many of these conversations. And the hardest one I ever had also resulted in one of the best working relationships with a subordinate that I had. I did not want to have the conversation. He did not want to have the conversation, but we had it. And I learned some things that were going on with him. We worked through available resources. He really dug in to improve on a conduct and performance issue. And I learned so much from that situation, was just saying, hey, we want to see you succeed. Because we do. We have very few employees that we don't want to see succeed. There's already been some investment if they're in the organization. And I learned, that was probably the first one. And when I think back on that I was so nervous. And so practice is another thing. And that's hard.
Yeah.
Practice is hard, right? Because you're practicing on a real person.
Sets. I've heard this phrase before. Sets and reps. It's Brandon's phrase. Mm. What you're talking about is practice, not the game, practice. We're talking about practice.
Practice is so hard when we're talking about difficult conversations in real life with real employees, with real situations. Role playing
doesn't work. No.
And I shouldn't say that. I mean, if you have a chance to practice in the mirror or something, I don't know, practice. But the first time, it's really hard.
Yeah.
Because you're thinking, are they judging me, right? I feel like I'm coming in judging them. And if it's not hard, this is a little judgmental, I guess, what I'm going to say, but is, if you're in a leadership position and you're going to have difficult conversations, sensitive, personal, if it doesn't bother you, go find something else. It should always bother you.
Yeah.
And I think that goes into the sort of that compassion part too, is saying, let it bother you. Lean in, for that term, lean into the bother, lean into saying, I'm uncomfortable with this. What can I learn from this?
And
so every time,
still have the conversation.
Yeah, that's right. Because you learn something about yourself and about what you're capable of and how you address those situations. So, But practice is hard. You as a leader, you don't want to have a lot of practice, right? Yeah. You want your workforce to be golden all the time.
Yeah. We got a couple of minutes left.
Well, I'm just curious, are there, and I think you're right that the practice is really helpful. What about getting started? Are there any resources available to help people sort of think through these types of things?
What's a book? Give me a book recommendation.
I have two books, but because, you know, I was already thinking about, like, my go-tos.
Where are you?
But I do want to plug for our civilian listeners and leaders. Civilian EAP, I think Magellan has DoD Civilian EAP. They have resources for leaders. So can we do a whole other podcast on why EAP is awesome? EAP is really has just tremendous number of resources that are not just counseling and therapy. And I know like Don's Department of Navy's EAP in particular has supervisory support resources. So these are, you can contact EAP and say, I need some supervisory support helping you deal with situations at work. And they have really great resources to kind of help you walk through how to approach situations. And then I have, so you quoted Stephen Covey. One of my favorite books ever is Speed of Trust. I love that book. I've read it 3 or 4 times. I recommend it to everyone. I've used it in coaching with executives because the whole premise of the speed of trust is literally, quite literally, the speed of trust. When you have trust, when you've developed trust with your coworkers, it's a lot easier to have difficult conversations with them because they understand that you are not out to get them. They understand that you have their best interests at heart, so you can have the conversation and you can move on.
Mm.
You don't have to continue to repeat it over and over and over. It's quite literally faster when you have trust relationships with people. I think we all know that. Us sitting at this table, we trust one another, so we don't have to go in cycles when we're working through something. We can have a conversation and we go to the next step. And so establishing trust, but trust has to be honest. The other book is, so Speed of Trust is not an academic book. It's a business book. I think it's a great resource. And Kristen, you may get a kick out of this, but the other one I really like is super academic, and it is called Mindset by Carol Dweck.
I love that book.
I know.
Excellent choice.
And so it's...
Is it a textbook?
It's no, but almost.
It's not.
But it's very academic, and it's also more a parenting book. It's more developmental psychology, but it's about how people tend to have either a fixed or flexible mindset. And when you know how people respond to things going in, if you have an understanding of how they are likely to react based on their mindset, which is driven by their development, their parents, and all these, we're going to go real Freudian if we need to.
There we go.
But it's really interesting because if you have a basic understanding of what to expect when you go in to talk to a person, it's easier to shape that conversation by understanding how they might respond to you. So we don't have time to go into all the details of the, you know, like how a fixed mindset affects how people receive messages, but it's very different than someone who has a growth mindset, a more flexible mindset, and is willing to take information and learn from it and grow. It's really different. I love that book. Because it helps you look at people and say, here's what I might expect when I'm trying to work through a leadership relationship with that person.
Well, there goes my Amazon cart. It just filled up.
Pete's got more books
even
in
though,
his future.
Yeah, even though I'm an independent contributor and I don't have any ambition to ever manage again, I feel like these books would help me understand the pressure my boss has in managing me. How do I be a better teammate? How do I be a better independent contributor? Because you should understand the boss's perspective and how they can, and it's all part of emotional intelligence, right? I mean, we haven't talked about EQ, but I think it is.
We didn't talk about EQ, but it's all EQ.
It is all EQ. Like, it can't be a good boss to manage people if you don't know your own self.
Hard charging, do it my way.
Not gonna work.
You've done bad is when we're talking about insider threat, that is why we are here. It's going to make the situation worse almost 100% of the time.
I had a great boss one time who was a Marine who didn't even have that attitude. He's just, you know, emotional intelligence, smart, compassionate, and I'm like, were you really a Marine? Like, really? Like, it just didn't.
It's a winning combo.
And a drill instructor? Wow. Mm. Okay, cool. Yep. Like,
and good at having difficult conversations.
Very good at having difficult conversations. Lots of sets and reps.
Maybe we never know.
I think a lot of it has to do with just the strategies, right? The BTAC bulletin. And I know I'm in the audience here, and I'm a groupie. Like, truth be told, I sit back and listen to all of you, and I have for 2.5 years, and just amazed at the amount of knowledge and experience. But this podcast and the bulletin, as a practitioner, as a manager, and a leader, the value is the strategies, right? Helping folks that live this in and out every day apply practical, useful techniques and skills that contribute to the trust and a better workforce. So you guys are amazing. Thanks for I know we're coming to an end, but I just have to say what a wonderful experience and the evolution of the BTAC. Now that's beyond the bulletin. Two perfect voices made for radio.
Thank you.
Engaging. So, you know, I'm
sliding a 20 across the table. Thank you very
well, much. Well, I tore out that page in my notebook.
Oh.
So we're good.
Good. Thank you. And I have a Sharpie. In my bag. If you want to,
like, and you can always call Whitney and ask for some direct advice.
Coach Whitney. Last question. I tease Kristen all the time. I'm like, so you're a psychologist. Does that mean you're constantly assessing the general public and then maybe me? Like, hey, you keep fixing your hair. It's been 5 minutes. Like, maybe we should talk about this tick that you have. For you, do you walk into any place? It could be a Target. It could be a Starbucks. It could be a company. And you all of a sudden, it's just on. You're assessing from the go the organization. Or are you able to turn it off, put boundaries up, and just be Whitney?
Wow. I don't know. You should ask my husband. He'll probably tell you. I think when things are good, no, I'm just me, right? Cool. But the instant things turn sour, you think, oh, they could be doing this better. And so probably a little bit of an arrogant approach when things aren't going my way.
You're a coach. I mean, you, if you're structured as a coach and you have this knowledge, you sharing is caring. You want to give. I've heard.
But the barista at Starbucks really doesn't care.
She doesn't. She wants the 20% tip that comes into the.
That's right.
Yeah, exactly. But, like, sharing is caring. And I think that you want to share your knowledge, and you should share your knowledge. Last question for me. What do you do to unwind? The topics we deal with are heavy. Mm-hmm. From an HR perspective, they can be frustrating when you're seeing maladaptive after maladaptive after maladaptive. How does Whitney care about herself? What do you do to relax and unwind?
I read a lot, and not academic books. I read, you know,
fun things,
and
the things you want to read.
And I love my dogs.
Oh,
I mean, you guys know I talk about them all the time.
We have that in common.
They are. I called. So we had a particularly rough case a few weeks ago, you guys probably remember, and so I started calling my dog EAP. I said, perfect. I need to consult EAP. Come here, Odie. And so, yeah, and you know, so my family and
awesome.
My dogs, but I do unwind. I do. We have to disconnect, and they're thankfully mostly we can.
Good.
Yeah,
balance is very important with this work.
Yes.
Well, thank you, Whitney.
Thank you. Thank you for coming and having what hopefully wasn't a difficult conversation.
No,
yeah, exactly. Like, I'm feeling, that's a great, great, great end. Like, this wasn't hard, right?
It was not hard.
We feel like we're gentle. We're friends. It's like, you know.
Yeah, future potential guests. We're not too scared.
She gave us another episode idea, a topic of EAP. And then there's also, well, you got to ask my husband. Well, I guess we have to have him on a podcast, him here.
He's going to jump right at that.
Let me tell you about Dr. Whitney. This was not a difficult conversation. This was a really nice conversation.
Agreed.
I learned a lot.
Indeed.
And I think our audience did too. Right, Kristen?
Yeah, I hope so. And really appreciate all of you for being here with us today. Come back next time for another great episode of BTAC Beyond the Bulletin.
Thank you, Kristen.
Bye. Take it easy, everybody.
Thank you.
Thanks.
The views and opinions presented herein are those of the interviewer and or interviewee and do not necessarily represent the views of the Department of War or its components, including Defense Counterintelligence and Security Agency, or DCSA. Further, any reference to the use of specific resources or consultation with non-government personnel does not constitute endorsement by the Department of War, its components, or DCSA.